And welcome to Backstage Pass, a spinoff of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and I'll be talking with music writers, podcasters, photographers, promoters, groupies, and so many others who love rock and roll. So here's your Backstage Pass. Let's get started. I am back on Backstage Pass with author Lori Kay. She wrote the phenomenal book, Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper, My Life Leading Up to John Lennon's Last Interview. Welcome back, Lori. This has just been such an incredible series of interviews because you were there at so many pivotal moments in the music scene during the 70s all the way up until 1980 with this horrible murder of John Lennon. And in the last episode, we talked about how the interview came about, why you were going to the Dakota. And for those that didn't listen, please go back, or if, more importantly, go read Lori's book. But I wanted to set the stage for our last interview for now, which is, it's December 8th, 1980. You've arrived, you're in New York. From reading your book, you were not able to eat that much, so you were hungry. But you're excited because you're going to go interview an icon. But you've also been told the rules for the interview of do not bring up the Beatles. You're only there to discuss Double Fantasy, the new album with John and Yoko Ono. And yet John himself broke that immediately, that rule. And so set the stage for us. I mean, there you are. You're a young journalist. The Beatles are one of your favorite bands ever. John Lennon, you're about to interview him. What was it like? What did you wear? How did all this go?
Well, first I should mention how December 8th, 1980 happened to be chosen in the first place. And that is, just a couple months before, we'd all been told that we were going to get to interview them once Double Fantasy came out. And we had to figure out what the best date would be. They had to figure out what the best date would be. And Yoko was working with her astrologer, apparently, who ended up having somebody call me and the three guys that were going to be as part of the team and ask us our birth date, our time of birth, other questions, so they could figure out what would work best. And for some reason, December 8th, 1980 was chosen, which is so freaky considering it turned out to be the most tragic day in rock and roll history to me, especially since John and Yoko were actually supposed to be in Hawaii and on the West Coast at that time, but they changed their plans due to all of our birthdays and timing. So, of course, we didn't know this as we went to the interview, but afterwards, it definitely hit me in the head all the time. And as we walked up to the Dakota from our limousine, it was just so exciting. And we walked in and we were in their public office for a few minutes. And their assistants were saying, well, John and Yoko are upstairs in their apartment taking pictures for Rolling Stone magazine. And I immediately thought, oh my God, I know what they're going to say. And the assistant said, yes, they're with Annie Leibovitz. And I thought to myself, oh God, no, because I had had a horrible experience with Annie Leibovitz myself.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was in Seattle and I did a very early morning newscast in Seattle and had to be at work by about 5 a.m. every morning. But I was asked by a publicist, a big publicist who had helped me a lot, can you please come the night before to Annie Leibovitz's lecture before her show opens up at the University of Washington? And I said, no, I really can't because I have to be at work early the next morning. And she said, oh, please, this is important to me. And I said, oh, okay. And she said, and after her lecture, you'll be doing an interview with her. And I said, okay, fine. And she said, and you'll air it so people will come to the show of hers. And I said, okay. So I went and I listened to her very long lecture that she did. And I went up afterwards backstage to talk to her. And I told her who I was, a radio newscaster, and I was about to interview her. And she said, Don't be ridiculous. Who would ever ask a radio person to interview a photographer? And she walked away. And I thought, oh, what a bitch. And I immediately said to myself, never again. I'm never going to look at her photographs again, ever. So when I heard that she was upstairs with John and Yoko, I started freaking out because even though, of course, her photograph, especially of John and Yoko on the floor with John naked and Yoko clothed, did turn out to be one of their very best photos together ever, it still freaked me out. Like, oh my God, if she's going to come down during our interview, what am I going to do? I'm going to want to smack her. But fortunately, she never did. So that was good. I never had to talk about her or see her again. So that was really great. And our group got taken into what was their private office, which was primarily Yoko's, where she did the work for basically John's company, which was also hers by then too. And it was just an amazing room with incredible, huge white shag carpeting and a great big grand piano, also white, and a beautiful, beautiful, long glass top coffee table that had man-made metal snakes climbing up the legs. And it was just so impressive because it was right in front of the love seat where I sat, and John Lennon ended up sitting right next to me. And throughout the whole interview, I was looking down at those snakes thinking, oh my God, am I really here? Am I dreaming? Is this really happening? And of course, it was really happening. And it was an amazing interview.
Well, there in your book, there is so much detail to this interview. And I encourage everybody to pick up a copy because you feel like you're in the room. But one burning question, and maybe this is just me being so excited for you, but I understand there's adrenaline in their nerves, but were you worried about what questions to ask initially before you realized how cool he was? How did you prep yourself for this?
Well, on the flight over, I was basically doing my job before the interview, which was coming up with all the questions for me and Dave and Bert to ask. He asked a little bit too. And I made sure not to talk about the Beatles or about anything before John and Yoko's Double Fantasy. Because as I was also looking at a recent print interview that had come out in Playboy, I realized that John was really kind of getting very upset with the author of that interview, had been bringing up his past and everything. So I made sure that we weren't going to. And I didn't. I let John bring it up himself. It was amazing. And then sometimes I would jump in and ask him to continue a little, like when he mentioned meeting up with Yoko. And I said, oh, do you think you could tell us the story? It's such a great story. And I figured, he'd give me like a 10-second version, more like a 10-minute version. It was amazing. And that's all in the book as well, and the audiobook too. So it was very cool.
That's amazing. And so you're conducting this interview. I don't mean to put emotions into you, but you must have just been flying high. It's going better than you could have imagined. You spoke on episode one about the little toy dragon that you brought for Sean and that John loved it. And so you're all getting along famously. You wrap up the interview, but talk a little bit about what happens at the end. The car didn't come for them. They were going to the recording studio. How did the meeting or the interview dissolve into the next phase?
Well, at the end of the interview, John himself wound up the spark-breathing, fire-breathing dragon that I brought for Sean and watched it go up and down the coffee table. And he was so thrilled and thanked me so much for the present that at that point, I was pretty sure that he and Yoko would keep for themselves, as Yoko had said, rather than give it to Sean. We ended up doing autographs. John autographed my copy of Grapefruit and also a copy of my Double Fantasy album and the other guys too. And we all took pictures. I took my picture with John and Yoko. The other guys each took a picture with John and Yoko as well. And Yoko got a call saying that, unfortunately, their car, their limo driver, wasn't going to be able to take them to the studio where they had a session afterwards. And so Yoko asked if we could take them in our limo. And I was the only one who was not going to be going back to the West Coast that night. I was staying in New York to be with a friend of mine. And the guys all said, yes, of course, even though their flight was coming up fairly soon. So we had to leave fairly quickly. And this was after we all made plans to get together in less than a couple of weeks when John and Yoko were going to be in San Francisco. We were all ready to go to Yoko's favorite Japanese restaurant there and have dinner. And I was so excited. I thought, oh, the first meetup with my new lifetime friends. This is so cool. And me and the guys left, and John and Yoko came out a couple minutes later. But as I walked out first, this guy looked at me standing outside the Dakota and said, did you talk to him? Did you get his autograph? And I just ignored him. I just didn't even want to. He was just creepy. And when the guy from our record company came out, he started bugging him as well. But Bert gave him a copy of Double Fantasy that he had, an extra one, and said, here, John will be out. He'll autograph it for you. And when John came out, Bert said, can you autograph this guy's copy? And he did. And another guy took a picture of John autographing it later. And then all the guys and John and Yoko got in the limo after I hugged them all and said, bye, I can't wait to see you again. And they drove off. And I was just so excited, but so sad to have to say goodbye. And as I was about to turn around and walk away up to my friends that I was going to be seeing that night, that creepy guy who'd bugged me right as I walked out the first time started doing it again. Did you talk to him? Did you get his autograph? What did he say? What did he want? What did he have to tell you? And I looked at him and I said, leave me alone, and many other things. And I kept walking, and he was following me all the way down the sidewalk. And I was furious, and I didn't know what to do. I wanted to turn around and smack him, but I didn't, because I didn't want to be violent. I didn't want to get into trouble. And I just looked at him and kind of said something, swore at him and said, go away. And finally, he stopped following me, and I ran up to my friend's office. And by that time, I was feeling much better. And it was my friend, whose name was also Dave. And I said, oh, Dave, it was the best day of my life. It was so exciting. And we ended up going out to dinner because I was excitedly hungry because I hadn't eaten the night before. And after dinner, we went back to his apartment. And right as he was about to open up the door, he said, you're going to hear music when I open the door, because I turn my radio on before I leave, just in case somebody breaks in. That way they'll think I'm home and they'll leave and go somewhere else. And I thought, okay. And he opened the door, and there was about 2 seconds of music. And all of a sudden, a reporter interrupted and said, John Lennon has been shot, and he's in the Roosevelt Hospital. And I went, oh my God. And I ran out into the street and caught a cab immediately and took it to the Roosevelt Hospital, which had a big glass door. And when I grabbed, I got out of the cab, grabbed my purse, and looked in the door, and I was about to run in because I saw Yoko holding on to somebody who was obviously a good friend of hers, but she was crying hysterically. And later I found out that it was David Geffen who had done Double Fantasy with Geffen Warner Brothers Records. And I realized, just from how tragic Yoko looked and how she was crying, that not only would it upset her more if I walked in, because it would remind her of that day while they were still, why they were still in New York. And I realized, John just hasn't been shot. John's dead. He's been killed. I just knew it in my head, and I felt terrible. So instead of going inside the hospital, I walked to the right and went to the phone booth and called RKO Network in New York, which my former news director from KFRC was now head of. And she said, come immediately. we need your help then to do the interview. And she said, are you sure that he's dead? And I said, I just feel that he is, but no, it hasn't been announced and it probably won't be for quite a while. And it wasn't for several hours after that. Finally, it was announced at the news on the news, and we turned on the TV because it said that they'd arrested the guy who'd confessed to being the killer. And I looked, and it was that guy, the one who'd been bugging me outside the Dakota. And I immediately felt so freaked out and so guilty because I thought to myself, why didn't I go to the Dakota Security Department and say, this guy is bugging me, get rid of him, or call the police or something? But even if they hadn't called the police, maybe they would have looked at him and seen that he had a gun in the pocket of his coat, which I didn't. And so for the next 43 plus years, I felt incredibly guilty because maybe I could have prevented John's death.
Oh, Lori, that's just so heartbreaking.
It is, and I still cry. I'm about to every time I talk about it.
Of course you do. I my heart just hurts for you because I'm sure you've heard this from everyone, but you didn't do anything wrong. You're in New York. There's bugs there. There's people that will harass you. You did the right thing in that moment in time, and it just kills me for you that you've probably had, or not probably, you've relived this for 40 plus years of what if, what if, what if, what if, and this was a crazy person, and that was his intent, was to kill John Lennon. And you somehow, with this astrologist, numerologist who picked December 8th, 1980, and all of you were together, that is just a heavy, heavy, heavy karmic moment.
Absolutely. So I feel guilty because I didn't report this guy and because I was born on the day I was. And I know that sounds horrifying to people, but I can't ever get it off my shoulders as much as I try. And I do try constantly, but it's always going to be there. And that's why I never say this guy's name, because I don't ever want to give him the publicity that he wanted so badly. And I barely ever mention him to anybody if I can help it. And the thing is, all these years later, if I'm on a TV show or something, which I have been, and the people interviewing me mention his name, I want to scream at them and smack them and say, no, don't, because this asshole is still alive when John Lennon isn't.
Oh, I would never try to make light of what you've gone through or to spin it, because that's the last thing you need. But I also want to maybe say, as an outsider, I'm so grateful that it was you. You got an interview that I don't think anybody else would have gotten because of your life and what led you there and the fact that you gained their trust. And as horrific as this sounds, he was going to be killed regardless. That was the karmic fate. You just happened to be the one there to have that final interview and to have those laughs and those memories and to make these new friends. And it led you to that moment. And I hate that you walk around with guilt, and as opposed to a moment where you can say, maybe I was meant to be there.
Well, I am the only one of our RKO team that feels guilty. I know that for a fact. But the guys all felt terrible and still do. It still hurts our hearts and our heads when we talk about it together, and that's understandable.
Have you spoken to Yoko Ono since then?
No, and I did try at first to get in touch with her, and then a few years later when I moved to New York, I tried to get in touch with her again. But as I understand it, I probably just remind her of what was the worst day of her life, so she wouldn't want to. And I understand that, and I don't hold it against her. And when I wrote the John Lennon special, the 3-hour special, John Lennon, The Man, The Memory, another special that I named, of course I dedicated it to her. And that's what I still do. I pretty much dedicate my life and my career, a lot of it, to Yoko Ono.
And also to John Lennon. Speak a little bit about the lithograph of his that you purchased and what that meant to you.
I'm sorry.
Speak a little bit about the lithograph that you purchased of his after his death. You had it framed, and it's incredibly touching.
Well, it is. It's something that he created for Yoko when they were getting married, and it was a series of very sexy artwork that John did, which was cool, but wasn't necessarily something that I wanted. But what I really wanted was his poetry and his thoughts about it, and I bought a copy of that, even though there were only 300 copies produced in the whole world. And I spent all the money that I made from my John Lennon interview and special writing from RKO on it, because I didn't want to spend it on anything else. I wanted to dedicate my money and my thoughts to John. And I still have it, the lithograph up on my living room wall. It's just very cool.
That is really cool. So here we are now, it's 40 plus years later. It took you a long time to write this book. Was it because you weren't sure how to approach it? Was it not being ready? Was it more guilt? Talk about why it took you so long.
It was kind of all of that. Plus, I was so very busy with my career that I didn't really have time to write the book, because there was so much memory that I had to come up with, because I'm not a diary keeper, and I had to listen to all of my interviews, the tapes I had, and all the print interviews, read them, and to remind me of everything that had gone on, and even talk with a lot of friends to see if there were things that they might mention that I'd remember. And so I just couldn't do it for years and years. And finally, 40 years later, my mother had passed away as well, and I didn't want to write my memoir because it would have been very insulting to her when she was alive. And even though we didn't have a great relationship, I still didn't want to insult her, even though I knew she would never read my book because she didn't really care about anything I did. She never ever listened to my Beatles special either. So I waited until she passed away, and then right after that, COVID hit, and suddenly there was no more TV production happening, so I had free time, and I thought, oh my God, I'll use all my day and night to write my book. And I started to look for a literary agent and a publisher, and was able to come up with both, even though I'm not necessarily a celebrity at all, which is what even my agent said to me, major publishers were only looking for when it came to memoirs. I still found a traditional publisher because I wasn't about to self-publish. It isn't something I ever wanted to do. And it all worked out, thank God.
It surprises me, and this is a horrible thing to say, so I apologize, because it sounds harsh. I don't mean it this way. But as a kid who grew up in the entertainment industry, it surprises me that being able to say I was the last interview of John Lennon wouldn't have gotten you a book deal instantly, whether you were known or not.
Well, it got me a lot of interest right away from lots of agents and lots of publishers. But the more the COVID hit, suddenly all kinds of celebrities right off the bat started writing and coming out with their memoirs. So publishers and agents suddenly said, no, we've got too many others to deal with. So, you know, that was important. And also I was very honest with the fact that I hadn't solo conducted the John Lennon last interview. I co-conducted it with Dave Sholin. We were the two interviewers, and he had gotten a lot of credit too. But of course, he wasn't a book writer and isn't, and I'm the only one who's written a book. So that's, I think, what made me get all the publisher interest that I did, is that people were writing lots and lots of books about John Lennon over the years, bios, but mine wasn't a Lennon or Beatles bio. Mine was a Laurie K. memoir, the story of my life wrapped around December 8th, 1980.
As I have said before on our interviews, I think your book is just an incredible read. It is a page turner, but that's not an insult. That is a complete compliment. I said this to Madeline Beccaro in her book, In Your Mind, The Infinite Universe of Yoko Ono, and I'll say it about yours as well. The thing I love about now both of these books, but your book, since we're talking about you, is that for the most part, we know these cast of characters. We know Los Angeles, even if we didn't live there. We know the Beatles. We know the Ramones. We know Dick Clark. We know these people. And hearing it from your perspective is so exciting for all of us reading it, because in a way, it's like we get to fantasize of that could have been me. And that's what I love about your book, is that it's such an approachable read, but it's also an inspiring read, because as I said, every moment that you went through, I kept thinking her life was so fated. And yet at the same time, that's your tenacity. That's your own chutzpah, as we like to say, that just kept you going. And I just think it's so impressive, even with the fact that you honor your guilt and the what ifs and what could have been different. But with all of that said, you've written the book. I want more. You ended with the murder of John Lennon and the devastation of Yoko Ono, but your life has gone on. So do you have plans to write a volume 2?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for what seems like a glowing review. I really appreciate it.
It is a glowing review.
Thank you. And yes, you know, although I am very busy these days promoting my books with everything from podcasts to interviews to appearing on shows and stuff, what I really want to do eventually is write the rest of my life, because this is my memoir, my early life. And so much has happened since then. And I've had so many other also music related events happen in my life and jobs and everything that it would be very fun to be able to do. So hopefully I will.
Well, I think I so encourage you to do it. I realize that's a lot of me to ask since you have to do the work. But I think the fact that so much has happened, as you just said, after the fact that continues this trajectory of your incredible life, I know I can't wait for more. So please tell people in the meantime where they can find what we will now call Volume 1, Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper, My Life Leading Up to John Lennon's Last Interview.
Well, you can find it everywhere from Amazon to just about every bookstore website that exists, as well as the bookstores themselves. And what I usually suggest to people is go to my book's website, because then you can read more about me too. And plus, there's a section of it called Purchase that will give you links to all the places to get it, including my publisher's website. And the website is confessionsofarockandrollnamedropper.com. And the cool thing is also is not only can you buy my paperback book online, but you can also get my self-recorded, very recently released audiobook, which not only includes me and my voice, but also, as I've mentioned before, quotes from almost all of the interviews that I've done. So if you want to hear the Ramones talking, if you want to hear Paul McCartney and John Lennon and everybody else talking, that's a good place to go.
You had mentioned earlier that each chapter you have is named after a song, and I'm not going to give it away because I want everybody to read it. But the last line where you refer to being an author of a paperback, I just giggled and I cried all at the same time. It was like, chef's kiss. You ended it and started it perfectly, but it was really like, yes, Volume 2. I can't wait.
Oh, thank you. That's funny that you say that about the end of my book, because that's how I felt about it too. And it was really cool to be able to think back on all the favorite songs since I first started listening to music and try and figure out which ones would correspond best to the contents of each chapter. And I hope I did a good job.
Oh, you more than did a good job. I mean, you know, there was so, I don't know, maybe it's because I grew up in the music industry, but there was so many wink, wink, nod, nods within all these little Easter eggs that you put throughout the book, including the chapter titles and including that last moment of Paul McCartney. So Lori, thank you for being here. I can't wait for you to come back so that you and Madeline Beccaro and I can have a more in-depth discussion on these incredible characters that we, well, you not only grew up loving, but then got to love in person. So thank you for everything. I am incredibly grateful for you and your life.
Well, cool. Thanks for putting up with me and saying such great things about my book and telling people they should go and read it. Or
absolutely.
Listen to the audiobook. Thank you.
I say all of the above. Read it, listen to the audio, and then I can't wait for you and I to go have sushi. So until then.